It is one of the more intriguing traditions at the Walt Disney Company. A newly hired top executive must don a costume and play a Disney character in one of its theme parks. No one seems to know what character Michael Eisner played when he became chief executive of Disney 20 years ago. In the new book, Disney War, James Stewart suggests Eisner could have played any one of Disney's villains. When he showed the door to close friends Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Ovitz, it made headlines and landed Eisner in court, where charges of treachery flew. Author James Stewart says Eisner would have chosen a costume with a crown.
People do, in a shorthand way, who work there, refer to the company as the kingdom or the magic kingdom. And there are kind of the trappings of monarchy that attach really to all chief executives in America today, but especially at Disney, which is rooted in the imagery of these fairy tale medieval kingdoms. Eisner himself, and I think this became a tragic flaw, assumed the role, both in the imagination and reality, as the monarch, as the absolute monarch of this kingdom. And Disney really began to experience serious business and creative problems when Eisner decided to consolidate power entirely in his own hands.
Simply put, when he consolidated power in his own hands, what did that mean for the company?
Eisner's strengths were always that he was creative, that he was impulsive, he made snap decisions, he was willing to try things, he was willing to take risks. And all of those qualities were tempered by the people around him. Frank Wells, who was the president and chief operating officer, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who ran the studio and was really responsible for those big animated hits, and Roy Disney as well. Relations between Eisner and Frank Wells were already deteriorating when Frank Wells was tragically killed in a helicopter accident in 1994. So that removed him. Katzenberg famously believed that he had been promised to replace Wells as president. Eisner refused to do that. He increasingly froze Katzenberg out of the decision-making at the top, to the point where Katzenberg finally left the studio. And then increasingly, Eisner did not trust Roy Disney, the nephew of Walt Disney and a member of the board, the chairman of the animation division. And essentially, there was no replacement as the president until he made his disastrous attempt to bring in his best friend, Michael Ovitz. So at that point, in about 1995, Eisner had consolidated power almost entirely in his own hands.
You know, one gets a vision, and maybe you can tell us an anecdote from the book, but one gets a vision of a person grown very big, stomping on other people grown very small.
There is this kind of interesting motif that runs through the story in which Eisner clearly on some level, conscious or not, is trying to assert some kind of hereditary right to the mantle of Walt Disney himself. When he insisted, despite terrible screen tests, on being the host of the Wonderful World of Disney, just the way Walt Disney had done. But at the other extreme, which is, he made a point of telling me, as he's told many other people, that the name Eisner, if you put a D apostrophe in front of it and pronounce it in the French way, would be Disney, and that was the original name, French hereditary name, of the Disney family. Hmm. I came back around and asked him why he was calling attention to this oddity. And he said, well, I'm not really saying I'm a biological descendant of Walt Disney. But on the other hand, I was saying, well then why else tell the story? He's certainly implying that there is this kind of mystical link.
Were all the fights and the betrayals, were they all about power? Or were some of them about creativity or a vision of what Disney was?
Well, there were certainly fights over creative issues. I mean, one of the more amusing ones I thought was, for example, Johnny Depp's portrayal of the pirate in Pirates of the Caribbean, which, of course, with benefit of hindsight, became a huge blockbuster and a big success. But there were major fights over that film, and specifically, was Johnny Depp going too far? Was he too mangy looking? Why Eisner in particular hated the gold teeth that he had. And at one point Eisner said, you know, why have we hired the sexiest movie star in the world to have him look like that? Why was he wearing skirts? Why was he mincing around in an effeminate way? So there were these constant battles. And to the credit of the Disney executives, they ultimately said, look, we've either got to go with Johnny Depp or not. You know, we cannot start counting the gold teeth, although Eisner did demand that a certain number of gold caps be removed, which, by the way, Johnny Depp then on the sly stuck back onto his teeth in the actual movie. That's a kind of creative dispute. Those aren't the ones that created problems for Disney. It's the ones that were really over ego and power. For example, it was very revealing to me that Eisner wrote an email to the board in which he said that, you know, Finding Nemo was not going to be a success. It was going to humble Pixar. It was going to bring those people to their knees. I mean, this was about the force of wills, the contest of wills and ego between Eisner and Steve Jobs, and how Eisner had to, quote-unquote, prove, you know, who was really in charge here.
On Pixar, Steve Jobs.
Yeah, that's a great story.
How did he lose, if you want to say that Michael Eisner lost, Pixar? It's not just a one project, one movie, one TV show.
No, this built up over many years. The relationship became worse and worse and worse. But I think the defining moment came when he testified in Congress on the subject of digital piracy, and he denounced Apple Computer for its advertising campaign, Rip, Mix, Burn, which he felt was encouraging young people to steal music over the internet. Well, Steve Jobs, who's the chairman of Apple, is also the chairman of Pixar, and he was livid that an important partner of his had gone before Congress to denounce him and essentially accusing him of encouraging theft. So he called a Disney executive as an irate, and he said, I can't believe what Michael just did to me in Washington. And the Disney executive said, well, I can't believe that either. I'll check with Michael. It must be some mistake. So he called Eisner, and Eisner said, well, I never said anything about Apple in the testimony. I didn't say anything like that. 10 minutes later, the top aide to Jobs was back on the phone saying, I have the transcript in front of me, and he proceeded to read it. And that was just one clash that I think was an irreparable breach. So when it came time to renew the contract, Steve Jobs offered Disney a deal, which he very well knew Disney could not accept. And believe me, Roy Disney called after this all fell apart, and he had a pretty good relationship with Steve Jobs, and he said something like, well, when the Wicked Witch is dead, you know, we'll all be back together. And Steve Jobs agreed, and I think it's true that once Eisner is gone, there's a good chance that Pixar will renew a deal with Disney if there's a chief executive there they think they can trust.
James Stewart is author of Disney War. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.